Hi, and welcome to Recovery Radio. I'm your host, Steve Martorano. Join us each week as we speak to experts in the behavioral health field, fostering diverse and meaningful conversation on substance abuse and mental health. We are a week out of from the Veterans Day service and memorial that we have every year, of course, and we wanted to do yet another program on veterans and the kind of unique problems they're facing with regard to their mental health and or substance abuse in that context. So that's what the program is going to be about today. And as we mentioned in our introduction, we reach out to experts in the field of behavioral health. And today is no exception to that. With us is a first-time visitor to Recovery Radio. He's working now for Retreat as a clinician. And we want to say hello to Tom Murphy, who joins us today. Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am good, Steve. Thank you.
Thank you for your time. I appreciate that. There's a slew of statistics that try to measure the problem we're talking about with regard to veterans. But before we get into very deep into all of that, because the numbers are shocking, of course, let's find out a little bit about you and your background. How long have you been in this field, and where did you start?
I started working with adolescents in October of 1994, and did that for about 5 years, and then went on to a codependency family program. I was a night counselor there, and then went to Temple to get my master's degree. I went back at the age of 50.
Yeah.
And if anybody's 50, go back to school. It is fun.
I tell young people who are in college, take your time getting out. As long as I'm not paying for it,
that's right.
Stay in school as long as you can. So you went back to get your master's then. But what was your initial impetus in going into the field of mental health counseling?
Initially, it was went through a horrible divorce.
Is that right?
Yes, and ended up seeking treatment. It was just like total world crush, and it just like had to get put back together.
Came out the other end okay, apparently.
Absolutely.
It gave you a career, as a matter of fact.
Yes.
So you're also a veteran, right?
Yes, sir.
Tell us about your military background.
Out of high school, I went to junior college, and I had a blazing 197 grade point.
Okay.
And I decided this is not going to work. and ended up talking to the Marine recruiter in the little town in Illinois, Dixon, Illinois, and went into the Marine Corps. I was in with the end of the draftees, so it was a 2-year hitch. My goal was to get in and get out and get my college paid for. While in the Marine Corps, I ended up being a ceremonial guard in Washington, D.C., home of the Commandant.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting duty, and it did kind of accelerate my drinking.
That's interesting. Even in the non-lethal portion of the military, there's still that warrior ethic and all of that. We're going to get into that more when it leads to trouble at the other end. So you began with adolescence, and when did you move to the adult population with problems?
Oh, that was with the family program up at Karen. I was a night counselor. I'd have typically about 40 clients and do educational, psychoeducational lectures and different things. From there, I went to outpatient because going to grad school, my goal was to be basically to work at private practice. And I ended up being the sole clinician in White Deer Run's outpatient program in Harrisburg and found out very quickly that I do not like working alone. I need to have peers and other staff around that can just help ground me when I get mm-hmm. a little overwhelmed with the work.
Mm-hmm. And that's what got you out of retirement, right? You were retired at one point, right?
I retired January 2018, but I had also worked at Conowago Wernersville, which was a prison transition program. Inmates were getting 2 and 3 years shaved off their sentence if they would do 90 days in treatment. And some of them said, no, send me back. I'm not doing this. And then I went to Gaudenzia in Coatesville. I was actually taken into Westchester as a clinical supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
After about 2 years, I decided I don't like this. Can I please be a counselor again? And they let me go to another office and be a therapist.
So that brings us to retreat. You're here, yes. Now. You're here now 3 months, only 3 months, right?
Yes, a little over 3 months. I retired January 2018, and me and my beautiful little dog, Nellie, we were having a wonderful life. And then I saw an ad for a second shift therapist. And I was like, ooh, I like second shift. And everything just fell into place. It's just like, kind of like, I think, a gentle nudge from a universal life force or whatever.
So tell us a little bit about a second shift. That's, what are those hours and what goes on during a second shift at a mental health or behavioral health facility?
Typically, you come in, we have a staff meeting. We're first thing off with the clinical therapists. I'm the second shift guy for three primary therapists during the day. And I'm the go-to guy for all the clients. I think I've got probably about 27 or 30 right now. The population changes a lot. So it's always new people, the changing dynamic, and trying to bring the group together.
Yeah.
We do a 3:30 psychoeducational group, which runs an hour and 15 minutes. And then we take a break, we go to dinner. Then we do our campus connection, which is like a rundown of the day, and it brings the whole community together. It's sometimes you miss people, and you don't get to see them all the time, and you see them there.
Are all of your clients right now, all the patients you're dealing with right now, residential patients?
Yes, it's all residential inpatient.
Yeah.
Lot of them anywhere from 8 to 30 days, 60, 90 days.
Are they all veterans?
No. Small percentage, probably, I would guess about 10%, which is about the same as the normal population, about 10% veterans.
Yeah. I know that when the retreat moved from strictly a substance abuse treatment facility to a behavioral health facility, they saw an immediate increase in their veteran population. I think there are more veterans now in the residential program in Lancaster County than there have been in a very long time. So naturally, you would be seeing more of them. And that's what this program is going to focus on, the unique circumstances of their mental health and substance abuse issues, and whether or not specific kinds of treatment have to be applied to this population. So let's talk about the guys you know and that you deal with as a clinician who are veterans. Are they, give me an age, a sort of age bracket we're talking about.
Oh, I think about 26 all the way up into the 80s.
So you're seeing guys from who were Second World War veterans or Korean War veterans?
Korean, anyway. Yeah. So that's, second, I think in Pennsylvania, the last World War II veteran has passed.
Yeah, yeah. Vietnam era is heavily in attendance in this program, I understand.
Actually,
right?
Not.
No, is that
no,
right?
No, it's more Gulf War.
It's the Gulf War.
Yeah.
I'm interested in that because I wonder, I don't know whether this would just be your personal opinion and observation, but those two conflicts and the ongoing situation in the Middle East seems to have generated more problems for more servicemen than the post-Vietnam era. Am I wrong about that?
Diagnostic tools have gotten better. And, as the medical community gets more savvy with diagnosing,
yeah,
things become more evident. I mean, in Vietnam, they were saying 20% of all the veteran or active duty people were addicted to heroin. And they were scared to death that when they came back, there weren't enough treatment beds. Well, what they found out was about 96% of them just quit. They were no longer, their life was not in danger, and they basically reconnected with their families, their work, their social groups. Mm-hmm. And
you mean they just stopped using,
they just
abusing
stopped
drugs?
Using.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But of course, what would be overlooked in that context was the reason they were doing heroin in a combat situation.
Oh, yeah.
Because I'm of that generation. I had friends who came out of Vietnam and broken, but we didn't know they were different, but we didn't notice that there was anything, pathological about this. They were just different guys that come out of this experience. So we've gotten better at going, something happened over there, right?
Yes. I mean, the incidence was probably about the same in terms of injuries, traumatic brain injuries and substance abuse. When I was in the Marine Corps, I think substance abuse was at about 10%. They have zero tolerance for that today. And it just, like, the numbers have dropped radically.
Yeah. When you say they have zero tolerance in the military now for substance abuse, they're not drug testing people who are in active duty, are they? Do they do that routinely, or do they look for the signs now?
I think they would just look for the signs. I'm not really sure on how they do that. It's been... I got out in 1976.
Yeah, a few years ago. Well, with regard to things like post-traumatic stress, which we're going to talk about at length today, we are now more easily diagnosed now than it would have been in the Vietnam era, correct?
Yes, it is. They actually screen for that prior to them getting out.
Oh, they do?
I mean, they do a transit. There's a transition program that they participate in to deal with stress and to help reintegrate them into the community. Or back into their lives.
Mm-hmm. What sort of things are we seeing from the veterans that are from, you know, way back and today? Are they the same kinds of things? What kinds of problems do these people face?
They basically biggest problem is trying to reintegrate into the community. They don't know where they fit, and they don't feel understood. One of the biggest hurdles is, you're not a veteran. You don't know what I feel. I was at a workshop down in Tennessee, and there were 45 veterans there, and I was not a combat veteran, and that had been my biggest fear, that I wouldn't be accepted by the group. But it was absolutely wrong. Accepted fully because I had served my time, and you are part of the family.
Right.
We run into that with treatment providers that are not military. The veterans hold back because they have a lot of stuff. I've seen veterans hold on to stuff for 10, 20 years and never disclose it. And it eats away at them, and it is one of the major reasons they turn to substance use disorder.
Yeah. They share this withholding with people who may not have been in the military but have had substance abuse problems, that sense that you can't know what I'm going through. In addition to that, they also run headlong in. Before we get into that, so we're integration back into society is very difficult. I remember it's a wonderful scene in a terrific movie called Hurt Locker.
Yes,
where the principal character is this guy who defuses bombs, and it's incredibly dangerous, but he thrives on the tension of it all. And then he's rotated out at one point in the movie, and they go from him being in combat and defusing bombs and seeing people blown up to walking down a supermarket aisle. And this is the first place we see the character out of position and confused and anxious. When he's in combat, he seems to be operating on an automatic level. When you talk about the transition, that's pretty shocking for them, isn't it?
Absolutely. And the training they go through is to do the job, no matter what. While that guy is out defusing bombs, he probably has half a dozen or more people providing security for him personally. You get out, you don't have that same overwatch feeling that they're watching out, they're protecting me.
So in the context of military behavior, you're trained to do the job. And you're trained also to have a kind of tunnel vision about the job. This is the job I have. This is what my concentration is. So everything else can be walled off.
Including your feelings.
Including the way you feel. When you get back in the real world, the regular world, the regular world's not playing by those rules.
No, and it's very hard to reopen that box. I mean, some of them don't know what a feeling is. You know, how are you feeling today? Oh, I feel good. No, how about mad, glad, sad, scared, lonely? A feeling word.
Yeah. So the psychological impact is probably easiest to see. But there are other problems that they have in conjunction with their military service that have to do with physical injuries. Can you talk about a couple of those?
I've worked with a number of veterans that have been rotated out because of injuries. It might be a training accident, or it might be it can be like a torn up knee or shoulder, things like that, and they basically say your service is no longer needed, and then they go through horrible depression because I was in for 10 years and then they just told me to go. And it's just like, you know, they were planning on being there for life. That was going to be their career. Now what do they do? And it's just like, you're not wanted. You transition to a civilian job, and maybe because of a traumatic brain injury, you have physical symptoms that make you unsafe in the workplace.
Yeah. Talk about the traumatic brain injury, because I think this is not a new thing, obviously, but it is certainly, I'm guessing, a new diagnosis that people are now being aware of. So it doesn't mean being hit by something in the head. It can mean a lot of different things, can it?
Oh, it could be just the concussive backlash from an explosion. I mean, if you and I are sitting here and something explodes on the desk, we could both have a TBI without ever being touched. But the concussion of that causes the brain to rattle around in our skull and causes damage.
So how is that diagnosed? Someone comes to you. Someone comes to a place like Retreat, and they may be here primarily because they've got a substance abuse problem. When do you begin, or how quickly do you begin looking at underlying or co-occurring problems? I mean, somebody may be self-medicating themselves, right, not for emotional reasons, but because they have an actual injury, right?
Right. And assessment begins day one. But most of the vets we get have already been assessed through the VA. They know what's going on and have dealt with this stuff for a number of years.
Our guest is clinician Tom Murphy. He is also a retired military, a Marine Corps veteran, and he's with us discussing the group of veterans he's dealing with right now. Some interesting stories about what those guys are facing. So, Tom, let's talk about this co-occurring situation, mm-hmm, where they're both psychological or mental issues that go hand in hand with substance abuse. What are you seeing among the vets you're dealing with?
Well, I've got a dear friend, and he'd been out. He was Gulf War vet, and he'd been out for 10 years, and his traumatic brain injury kicked in. I mean, debilitating headaches, couldn't remember things, and it just like, he got it checked out, got the diagnosis, and is getting treatment for it. I looked at him and I said, Billy, why don't you get a dog? And he's like, what? I said, a PTSD dog. You can get a dog from the military. They train them for you. Well, he's got a chocolate lab now that is just the most wonderful dog in the universe.
And it works for him?
It works. Yes, it keeps him calm.
You know, a lot of people
train them specifically.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people hear about service dogs. I mean, we're all familiar with seeing eye dogs,
mm-hmm,
but that concept of a dog that can help, or an animal that can help, actually,
yes,
has been broadened considerably over the last 20 years or so. And I think there's still a kind of not a prejudice about it, but a kind of suspicion about, come on, what are we talking here? How could a dog help,
right,
somebody who's got traumatic brain damage or post-traumatic stress? What's going on there? Just a calming influence?
It's a calming influence, but the dog is trained to recognize physical cues. I have a friend, her son is on the spectrum of autism, and he has a service dog. When he starts to get anxious and his anxiety starts to kick before he acts out, his dog comes up and pushes against his legs and just nuzzles his hand, and that's a calming thing. That's his signal to, oh, it's happening again. And the same thing with veterans. The veterans' animals become what's an unconditional love relationship. And it's, I think, integral to healing.
I guess it's also part of the reconnecting to something outside of themselves.
Absolutely.
Right? Let's talk about a couple of other things that may be going on with veterans that have contributed to their not only mental health but their substance abuse problems. Pain management would be
Absolutely.
One. A lot of these guys get out and have serious injuries that require pain management, for instance.
Yes.
There was a problem with that for a while.
Yes. I mean, you're out in the field, you're 180 pounds, and you're carrying 80 pounds to 100 pounds of equipment. It's going to take a toll on your knees, your back, and your hips. Docs would prescribe the opiates, oxycodone and Percocets and that. But then as they take these things, the pain increases over time. So the dose has to come up
right.
over time.
Mm-hmm. And so they're over-prescribing it for all the good
right.
reasons. But these guys are now wind up seriously addicted to this stuff.
And then when they get cut off from the doc, then heroin becomes an option. And now today with the heroin, they're lacing it with fentanyl. I've had clients in and out of the military that use heroin, and fentanyl shows up in their blood or their urine screens,
mm-hmm.
and it's just like, you need to quit doing this, you're going to die. Oh, no, I know what I'm doing.
Right, right.
I mean, I had to, at one point, I got a state parole officer involved with one of my clients, and we were going to lock him up because it was the only way to save him. Well, he died before we got to it.
Is alcohol the overwhelming choice of over-medicating themselves among the veterans you've seen? Is that what they usually...
Typically, it's alcohol.
Typically, it's alcohol.
And then it can be other substances. You know, the day of the stone-cold alcoholic is kind of gone because there's always other substances involved.
Well, you're a veteran. I don't realize you're not a combat veteran, but you certainly understand the military ethos that exists,
yes.
particularly a Marine. They may have invented this thing, the kind of warrior ethic, the behavior that when you're introduced to a military context is almost considered part of it, and drinking is mm-hmm. is one of those keys, isn't it?
Absolutely, it's the social lubricant. I mean, we're trained by society to be that way. I'm actually kind of lucky. I've had friends in the Marine Corps come up and they say, what's wrong with you? Why are you not like us? And I said, that's easy. I'm a man that was a Marine. You're a Marine that is a man. And it just like the indoctrination and the program.
And Marines can drink and hold their liquor.
Oh,
and,
absolutely.
In fact, it's kind of an unwritten rule.
Well, when I was in, it basically we had to had a club right on base, and it was basically government subsidized alcohol. It was cheap.
You know, you certainly understand how something like that could make sense in the context of unit cohesion and what they're trying to accomplish mm-hmm. in the military, and the effects of which don't become apparent until later on. What about things like insomnia, sleep problems?
Those are all can be associated or go along with the traumatic brain injuries, TBIs, or even the post-traumatic stress. It can be depression. I mean, sleep disorders. I've had clients that will wake up in the middle of the night or wake up the next morning, they look at their wife and wife has a black eye, and it's like, oh my God, what happened? And she looks at him and says, you hit me last night. And that, I've had clients come into treatment because of just that situation.
Let's talk about post-traumatic stress disorder. It's one of those phrases that's now tossed around as though we all understand exactly what it means.
Mm-hmm.
There is no really one definition of what it is, right?
There's a number of definitions, and it can be a number of different things. It's typically about a horrific event that you witness, that you're actually close to, and how it impacts the brain. The plasticity of the brain, once you're exposed to trauma, it starts to change the way your brain is wired. And it's just like you start to think differently.
Yeah. Is the part of that rewiring process pushing down on the memory of the trauma? In other words, ignoring it or denying it and looking for other reasons why I feel tense all the time, or I'm angry all the time, or I can't sleep, and never making the connection that it has to do with your military service?
And it's difficult to do. It depends on what's going on in their life. You have to do a complete and thorough history to find out. There's the ACEs test. It's the Accumulated Childhood survey. Kaiser Permanente and the Center for Disease Control did this with 17,000 people, and there are like 10 questions. And if you have four yeses on this, you typically are going to be engaged in a drug or alcohol problem. You're going to have heart disease. You're going to have some difficulty down the road.
And when that occurs, mm-hmm. you are considered to have post-traumatic stress.
No. Those are the things that set you up for drinking and all the things that you could get PTSD. PTSD, let's use 9/11 for an example.
Mm-hmm.
People that were there, severe post-traumatic stress disorder, can't sleep every time they close their eyes, it reoccurs. I contend that that was televised live worldwide. And it's like...
So a lot of people got traumatized by that.
Yes. Well, and there's a secondary traumatization. But, you know, in a classroom of school children, elementary ed, they're watching these towers fall and 6,000 people die. And that doesn't leave a mark.
Yeah, we probably haven't seen all of the results of that. Oh, no. I know it's been a while since it happened.
I was working inpatient when that happened, and it changed the way we all started to look at everything around us. There's a suitcase in a corner. Whose is it? There was a psychologist in Reading that actually did a group to help people with some secondary traumatization, a.k.a. maybe post-traumatic stress disorder, after 9/11. And I went to that group for about 6 months, and it just helped.
You know, we are now a full generation or more with more and more women in the military than ever before, certainly mm-hmm. in my lifetime and yours as well, and in combat positions.
Yes.
Now. Are they as susceptible to these problems of mental health and substance abuse as their men colleagues?
Probably a higher percentage. There's fewer women in the military, but their trauma can be... there can be more trauma. Typically, a lot of women in the military have been exposed to sexual assault. I think they call it, MST, military sexual assault. Mm-hmm. It has its own little acronym now. But because of this coming from someone you see every day, they're in a position of power, and they have perpetrated upon you, and it's just like, and it's not only women, it's men.
Yeah. Well, the chain of command and all of that.
Absolutely.
Kicks in, and you just don't complain up, right?
Right. I know of one individual that... they basically ran him out of the service so that he couldn't bring a complaint because the powers that be conspired to do him in.
Don't want to hear that. Tom Murphy, clinician here at Retreat Behavioral Health, is our guest. We're talking about treating veterans. Tom, I want to make this point a little further with regard to how people suffer who do from their military service, or what they had going on in their lives is exacerbated by the whole situation, and it can result in substance abuse and mental disorders. You mentioned that even in your experience as a young guy, you weren't a scholar. You weren't interested in business. You were sort of at a young age going, now, you know, what do I do? And so you chose the military, which made a lot of sense for mm-hmm. you, and it worked out fine. But a lot of people enter the military under that notion that things are really messed up, and the military career will straighten it out for me.
Yes.
It doesn't always work out well, does it?
No, it doesn't. I mean, back in my day, the judge would send you to the Marine Corps.
And then there was that, where you had the choice between going yeah. to jail or going to the Army.
Yeah.
So while we focus on the effects of military life, particular combat situations, as the cause of a lot of the problems that veterans suffer from, alcoholism, substance abuse, mm-hmm. anger issues, and all that, some of this stuff must clearly predate their military service.
Absolutely. I mean, post-traumatic stress disorder. I played football in high school. It's just like, how many shots to the head did I get? It's just like, I have a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress disorder. I don't believe I got it in the military, but I definitely know that it got aggravated there. But, you know, in terms of screening before they go in, that could be a bigger problem.
Yes, because what comes to mind for me immediately, and I'd like to ask you what you're experiencing as a clinician, is something like anger management, which is a big problem, particularly for men, I would suppose. Prior to getting into the military, when you talk about screening, that wouldn't be something that would preclude you. I mean, preclude you automatically from being a good soldier. They, in fact, might look at somebody who's edgy and ready to jump into the middle of something as like, okay, that's okay.
Right, but they would screen the more severe cases. But it just like it may be a setup for a lot of the veterans. We were talking in my group about resiliency. You know, resiliency is about the ability to bounce back from traumatic events. Well, they're just like everybody else, but then we go into military and we get a lot of that trained out of us. So it's just like they're having, I'm looking at that as one of the major coping mechanisms they're tried to teach, because resiliency is a skill that can be taught.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's how fast do you bounce back?
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about your group, the group you any group that you deal with, and particularly in the context of former combat veterans who are in there. How big a problem is managing their anger in the context, you know, in the therapeutic context when they're in the room with you?
I had a situation right after I started. A veteran is angry. He is over the top. He's ready to start taking names and go to work, basically. He had been through three different therapists. He ended up in my office. And I just looked at him and I said, rules of engagement. And he swore at me.
What did you mean by that?
Well, what are the rules of engagement? I mean, these people have been in combat situations where there are people throwing bricks and rocks and bottles and calling them every name in the universe, and they're...
So they react a certain way.
Their training says stand down, do not react, do not engage unless fired upon.
Yeah, yeah, and they and when the context changes to civilian life.
To civilian life, then it's... But it's sometimes just somebody knowing the right thing to say.
We have very easily accustomed ourselves, and correctly, to thanking people for their service. It's almost a cliche. It is a cliche, but cliches are all true. That's how they become cliches. So I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't do that, but it is not enough. I mean, in your view now, you've been in the field for a while, you are former military, the final couple of minutes that we have here. Are we serving them well enough in this regard? Are we getting them the help they need? Are we telling them how to do it? What's your take on that?
We're getting them the care that they need, but sometimes it's not as fast as the individual thinks it should be done. I see that as a giant problem. I started going to the VA for my medical care January 2018, and I swear to God, I've never had better medical care in my life. Thanking the veterans is nice. You know, people, apparently, like Veterans Day, they can go out to different restaurants and they'll get a free meal. And it's just like, I don't want to play that game. I got out in 76, and it was not a nice time for veterans. You know, and anytime someone says, thank you for your service to me, I kind of get a little cranky.
Yeah. And finally, we could do two more shows on what we need to do for veterans. Homelessness is a huge problem among
Absolutely.
That population. I guess we have to be much more aggressive in going out and finding who those people are, and getting them the kind of help. If there's a veteran out there listening now who knows that there's something wrong but doesn't know what it is, call the VA. What's your first suggestion to somebody like that?
Oh, to call the VA, to call a fellow vet. In my groups, we're finding that just the one-on-one interaction between them, we had a guy that didn't think he was eligible for benefits, but there had been a change in his status, and he found out he was eligible for benefits, and that was a life-changing event for him.
Yeah, well, we like to say on this program, no matter what group we're talking about, that we want to remind you, in fact, it's the central premise of the show, there's help out there.
Absolutely.
And so if you're a veteran who's suffering, obviously, thank you for your service. But, you know, ask somebody for help because it's out there. Tom Murphy, thanks so much, Tom. We appreciate your time. Hope we can have you back again.
Okay. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you for joining us on Recovery Radio, brought to you by Retreat Behavioral Health. If you or a loved one is in need of help, their admissions office is available 24/7 at 855 855-859-8808. That's 855-859-8808.